Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking as we do most weeks at this time at the worlds of economics and politics. In a few minutes, we'll hear from economist Heidi Shierholz on the flabby, unsatisfying state of the job market, and then around the bottom of the hour, Sean Jacobs will tell us about the political economy of soccer. First, Heidi Shierholz. The employment report for June showed strong job growth and had a lot of analysts declaring the damage of the financial crisis and Great Recession behind us. Some Wall Street types are now worrying about how the unemployment rate is too low, giving rise to wage pressures. Imagine that, the horror of higher wages. And so the Fed should think about pushing up interest rates and slowing down the economy a lot sooner than it appears inclined to. Here's Heidi Shierholz of the Economic Policy Institute with some perspective. Welcome, Heidi. We've now had a string of several months with 200,000-plus job gains. We see people on Wall Street talking about the labor market getting too tight. What do you say to that?
We have had some pretty good job reports recently, so that's the good news. In June, we added 288,000 jobs. It brought the second quarter average to over 270,000 jobs on average per month. That's actually pretty decent job growth. So that, you know, and it's when you have 1 month of good job growth, you can't say anything about that because there's month-to-month variability in the data. But now that we've had several months in a row of pretty solid job growth, you can start to say, okay, this now makes a trend. So that's the good news. The sobering part of this is the context that it is happening in. Even if we were to get 288,000 jobs every single month from here on out, it would still take 2.5 years to get back to pre-recession labor market conditions. And that's because we are still in such a deep hole. We lost so many jobs in 2008 and 2009. And since then, except for the last few months, the pace of the recovery has been so weak that we just haven't made much progress digging out of it. And so we need this kind of growth and stronger to fully fill in the gap that we have in the labor market. In other words, we still have a ton of slack in the labor market. We still have a lot of idle plant and equipment. We have a lot of idle people. We are not getting too tight in the labor market so that, you know, we still need policy, macroeconomic policymakers to be doing everything they can to generate demand for goods and services because that's still the missing piece. We still have too much slack. We've had a few strong reports, but we need many, many more like this before we get anywhere near a tight labor market where macroeconomic policymakers would need to be pulling back.
A couple of months ago, we regained all the jobs lost in the recession. So now we're slightly above those levels, 500,000 or so above of the pre-recession peak. But that is, of course, is not enough.
Right. There was a lot of excitement when we crossed that level. Now you can officially say we have, you know, more jobs than we've ever had before. The problem with that is we're supposed to add jobs all the time, basically always add jobs, except in periods of recessions, which are thankfully relatively few and far between. So we're always adding jobs. So getting to the peak of a series that basically always rises isn't actually something to get that excited about. And you need to always benchmark that number against something relevant. And so the way I think is useful to think about this is to note how fast the potential labor force has grown in the last 7 years, since the 6+ years since the Great Recession started. We should have added more than 7 million jobs in the last 6+ years just to keep up with normal growth in the potential labor force. You know, babies being born and then hitting the age where they're going to enter the labor force. Just normally, we have population growth, so we have growth in the potential labor force. So we need to be adding jobs every single month just to hold steady. So we should have added over 7 million jobs since the recession began. Instead, we've just added a few hundred thousand. We now just have a few hundred thousand jobs more than we did before the recession began. So by my estimates, we are still in a hole of 6.7 million jobs in the labor market. We still need 6.7 million jobs to get back to health in the labor market, to get back to pre-recession labor market conditions. So we are definitely improving. Things are looking a little bit stronger than they have been, but we still have a long way to go.
I just saw a note from Deutsche Bank's U.S. economist this morning saying that people who say there's a lot of labor market slack are ignoring the fact that they're actually seeing wage growth. And we are seeing growth in average hourly wages of 2% or a bit above that year to year. Is that an alarming number?
No, and it's not happening in most series. So there's, you know, we have great government statistical agencies that provide a lot of different cuts at every sort of measure. And so we have a lot of different measures of wage growth. Most measures of wage growth aren't showing any acceleration in wage growth over the last year or so. And we're definitely seeing wage growth that's far below what it was before the recession hit, which is exactly what you would expect. When the unemployment rate is high, when job opportunities are very weak, it shifts the bargaining power away from workers. Employers simply do not have to pay big wage increases to get and keep the workers they need when workers don't have outside options. So that's the dynamic that's ruling the day right now, that the slack in the labor market is keeping wage growth low. There's one series, and it's the average wages of production and non-supervisory workers that shows some acceleration in wages over the last 9 months or so, but the wages of that group had fallen much further than for the labor market as a whole. Wage growth for that group is still extremely subdued, far below where it was before the recession hit. So we're nowhere near the situation where people should be putting on the brakes because they think, yeah, we're seeing accelerated wage growth that signals we might be sparking inflation. I think a decent benchmark is to note when wage growth starts to exceed productivity growth, that's when we should really start to worry, and we are nowhere near that yet.
Yeah, well, productivity growth has been exceeding wage growth on average for several decades, so there's some ground to catch up with.
Yes, that's right. And so there's right now what we see in the labor market is things are tighter now than they were a year ago, but there's still a lot of slack in the labor market. It's going to take a lot more increase in economic activity to get us back to pre-recession labor market conditions. And the concern now is that because things are tighter than they were a year ago, people are starting to say, is it getting too heated? And it's not. We still have a lot of slack in the labor market. It is not time to stop measures that would support the economy. We still are in a big hole. So things are getting better, but we're not yet in a place where people should, where macroeconomic policymakers should pull back.
This may sound a little perverse to bring up, but actually, we've got GDP growth. Well, last quarter was negative, but, you know, recent quarters it's been averaging, say, around 2%. That's not a big number. It almost seems as if employment is growing even somewhat more rapidly than GDP growth would suggest. Do you have any thoughts on if that, well, what do you think about that and what's happening?
Yeah, that was definitely true in the first quarter. The first quarter was strange because it really was, the GDP numbers really were affected by this very cold winter that we had. But by and large, there's not a huge difference between how fast GDP has been growing and how fast jobs are growing. In any given quarter, there can definitely be the two figures definitely don't match up quarter to quarter. But over the long haul, we've roughly seen job growth roughly match what we at this point in the recovery, we're now seeing job growth roughly matching what we're seeing with GDP growth. It certainly has not been the case so far in 2014, but overall, those two concepts are so tightly related that any short-run breaks between the relationship between GDP growth and job growth tend to get resolved in the next few quarters. And that's what I expect is still going on. So I don't think now that we're experiencing any major structural break in the general relationship we see between GDP growth and job growth. In other words, what we're seeing now is when demand picks up for goods and services, that's when we see employers need to bring people on and hire people.
And this, you sort of touched on this, but you know, you hear people, especially in the political left, saying that we are now in this new era of robotization, and that capital just does not need labor anymore, and that's why the labor market is so weak. It seems to me that the problem mostly is we have very slow growth, and that there is no breakdown in the relation between job growth and economic, broad economic growth. What's your opinion?
Yeah, I think that's right, and we have good measures to look at to assess this claim of, is one of the reasons that we're having slow job growth right now, or in this recovery, because of increased technology, robots are taking our job, or employers are working employees faster and harder than they used to, so they don't need as many people. That is actually a very plausible theory, and it's the good thing is that it's very easy to look into. We have good measures of productivity growth. So productivity is the average amount of goods and services that workers produce in an hour of work. If we were seeing, you know, the robots taking over, and meaning that we didn't need, or I'm using robots to shorthand for just technological advances, if we were seeing technological advances that were happening at such a rate that we didn't need to hire as many people as we used to, or if we were seeing employers work their workers that much harder and sort of more efficiently that we didn't need more workers than we used to, we would see an acceleration of productivity growth. And that we have not seen. So this is something that would show up in productivity growth if it were happening, and it's not. One key thing to keep in mind, however, is that productivity has definitely grown since the recession started. But the key is that it always grows. I mean, every once in a while there's a quarter where productivity doesn't grow, but basically productivity is always increasing. So the question, the right question economically to ask is productivity growing faster now than normal or slower now than normal? And what we actually see since the Great Recession hit is that productivity has grown more slowly than it usually does, which is not unexpected. When you have a big slump in the economy, investment slows down, it all sort of grinds on productivity growth. Not only are we not seeing such an acceleration in productivity that, you know, we need to hire fewer people, we've actually seen productivity grow more slowly since the Great Recession hit on average than it was growing before the recession. So the theory, which is plausible, which was plausible on its face, that technological advances are meaning that we don't need as many workers as we used to, actually doesn't hold up when you look at the data.
I'm speaking with Heidi Scherholz, who is a labor market economist at the Economic Policy Institute in Washington. And continuing on that theme, when we saw the productivity acceleration of the late 1990s, it came along with an acceleration in corporate investment, particularly in high-tech gear, which continued into the early 2000s. Lately, we've seen pretty low levels of investment, real investment, by corporate America. What could we expect from productivity from here going forward?
There is a concern that we won't see the kind of productivity growth that we have been seeing. So the weak labor market can put sort of erode productivity growth as businesses, you know, they don't see a need for investment when they know that there's not the demand there for their goods and services. Even things like the decline in population growth can reduce investment because, you know, there's fewer businesses know that there's not an ever-accelerating demand for goods and services, and so there's less incentive to make these investments. So those kinds of things do mean that there's a possibility that we could see a slowdown in productivity growth going forward. There's measures that we could take to deal with this. So Washington is not thinking along these lines, but the government can make big investments. If we would do things like deal with our trade balance through, I mean, we can address our trade balance through exchange rate policy. We could increase demand in the United States, which would increase incentives to invest. So there are policy levers we can pull to address this. But there is, you know, pulling those policy levers to address this, there is some concern that we'll see this ongoing slump in productivity. And that's actually, as far as the the overall economy goes for the long run, productivity growth is a really good thing. It's what lays the foundation for living standards growth. If you see productivity growth, which means on average workers are producing more per hour, that's what makes it possible for the economy to as a whole, for people in the economy to see living standards growth. Productivity growth doesn't mean that the vast majority of people will see productivity growth. As we know, since the 70s in the United States, we've had pretty strong productivity growth, while the vast majority of the population hasn't seen strong wage growth. But that productivity growth is a necessary condition in order to see broad living standards growth, which is what we want in our economy.
And returning to the issue of labor market slack, I mean, the most visible conventional measure of slack is the unemployment rate, which has come down from roughly 10% at its peak during the Great Recession to just over 6% now. How accurate a measure is that of labor market slack?
The unemployment rate is better at sometimes than others at measuring trends in labor market conditions, and right now it's not that good of a measure. The problem is that in order to be counted as officially unemployed, you have to be actively seeking work. In our labor market, job opportunities have been so weak for so long that we have a big pool of workers who, in better times, would be looking for work, but instead have just given up, stopped looking for work, or never started looking for work. So we have this big pool of workers who would be either working or looking for work if job opportunities were strong, but instead have been just sidelined. That big pool of workers, missing workers, means the unemployment rate isn't all that useful right now for assessing trends in labor market conditions. Just for an example, the unemployment rate is 6.1%. I estimate that there are around 6 million workers, these missing workers who are not employed or looking for work, but if job opportunities were strong, they would be. They would be either employed or in the labor force looking for work. If those 6 million missing workers were looking for work, the unemployment rate would be over 9% right now instead of 6%. So that just gives you an idea of the scope of this issue, that this is really a sort of meaningfully sized group. That means the unemployment rate is understating slack in the labor market. But fortunately, the BLS, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, they produce a host of measures. So we do not have to depend on just the unemployment rate to get a sense of the strength of job opportunities in the labor market. One of the alternative measures I like to look at is the employment to population ratio, which is just this broad brushstroke measure which looks at the share of the working age population that has a job. So it completely sidesteps this issue of whether jobless workers are either looking for work or not looking for work. It's just a ratio of how many people are employed out of the working age population. And that measure has shown some improvement in this recovery, but not nearly as much as what the unemployment rate has shown. And I think that underscores that much of the improvement that we've seen in the unemployment rate in this recovery has not been because people are getting jobs. It's been because people are either dropping out of or never entering the labor market because job opportunities are so weak.
Yeah, the employment population ratio has barely changed since the recession ended, right?
Yes, okay, that's right. So we have not seen very much improvement at all in the employment to population ratio overall. So I will add one more layer of confusion to this whole thing and say one factor that's going on is even if the Great Recession hadn't hit, the employment to population ratio actually would have dropped over this period. And it's because we have this big group of people, the baby boomers, hitting retirement age. So this, when you have a big chunk of people who are crossing over retirement age, that employment to population ratio would drop naturally. There's nothing bad about that. It's just a demographic trend. It has nothing to do with the strength or weakness of job opportunities. So one of my favorite measure to look at is the employment to population ratio of quote unquote prime age workers. workers who are aged 25 to 54. Those are the ages in the U.S. labor market where people are very attached to the labor force. Those are the highest years of working or looking for work. And if you look at the employment-to-population ratio of people aged 25 to 54, you're completely sidestepping this issue of baby boomers hitting retirement age or, you know, increasing college enrollment of young people. You're just zeroing in on the people who are in their prime working years. And what you see in that measure is that there has been some improvement. It, you know, fell off a cliff in 2008 and 2009. It basically bumped along at the bottom of that very deep hole in 2010 and 2011. But since then, so 2012, 2013, the first half of 2014, it started to bounce back. And at this point, we're about a third of the way back. So we've dug ourselves about a third of the way out of the hole caused by the Great Recession. So there's still a long way to go, but I think that we've definitely seen improvement.
And finally, what can we do about, we have a problem of long-term unemployment and people who have dropped out of the labor force who many analysts and perhaps many employers think are gone for good, that once you're out of the labor force for a certain period of time, your skills deteriorate and you become radioactive to potential employers. What can we do about this problem?
The main lever to pull is to get back to health overall in the labor market. So that is the thing that will do the most to move the dial on our long-term unemployment crisis. If you look at the trends in long-term unemployment and in overall unemployment, they actually track each other quite well. So we definitely have a long-term unemployment crisis in our country right now, but it is part and parcel of the overall weakness in the labor market. So getting back to health more broadly is the most important thing. That, I think, is the key issue. There is good evidence that there's discrimination against the long-term unemployed. So there's been studies where people will send out resumes that are identical in every way except for one person is long-term unemployed and the other person, say, has a job or is short-term unemployed. And employers are much more likely to call back people who are not long-term unemployed. So there is deliberate discrimination against the long-term unemployed. People who are experiencing long-term unemployed will face the scarring effects of that. They will be, you know, when they do find a job, it's likely to be much lower wages than they otherwise would have gotten. But this idea that they're sort of ruined forever as workers doesn't quite pass the smell test for me. I mean, the question of are their skills being eroded? If you sort of sit back and think about the kind of jobs we have in this country, you can come up with a job where even if you're out for a couple of years, the world passes you by. But you kind of have to think hard. You may think in some kind of high-tech industry or computer programming or some sophisticated health industry. Most workers do not work in occupations like that. Most jobs in this country are not in occupations where if you take even a few years out, your skills erode so dramatically and you're so far left behind that there's no coming back. So it's certainly true for a few occupations, but I think it does not describe most work in this country. So I think that discrimination against the long-term unemployed is real, but I don't think these workers are ruined forever. I think that if job opportunities come back, they would get back in the labor market.
That was Heidi Scherholz, a labor market economist with the Economic Policy Institute in Washington. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Is this song any good? I'm not sure. We play, you decide.
Just thinking over, I've got lots of things.
of a sum of buried plans by Minor Alps. Now soccer, or as the rest of the world calls it, football. I am the last person in the world you'd call a sports fan, but I have an 8-year-old son who is very much one, and he's been obsessed with the World Cup. The World Cup specifically, and soccer in general, are fascinating topics with a political economist. Here's Sean Jacobs, an assistant professor of international affairs at the New School in Manhattan, who, among other things, teaches a course called Global Soccer, Global Politics, and, as you can tell, a major connoisseur of the game. Sean Jacobs. This is, the time of the year, or the time of the quadrennium for your soccer fanatic. It's all foreign stuff to me, so I am here to learn from you. Let's talk a bit about FIFA, the organization that runs the World Cup. Is it as much of a stink pot of corruption as it appears to be?
Short answer, yes. It presents itself as a non-profit, and it governs football around the world. You know, it all sounds good and well. It has, like, you know, an affiliate in South America, in what is known as CONCACAF, which is basically the Caribbean. If you're talking about this region, Central America and North America, it has UEFA for Europe. It has the Asian Football Association, and then it has CAF, which is for Africa. You know, it does a good way of organizing football. But the problem is two things about it. Firstly, it is really corrupt. I mean, there's just like no way around it. But it is a really corrupt organization where there is just a major lack of accountability. For starters, if they have to pick who's going to host the World Cup, there's always accusations, mostly true, about how voting gets influenced. How Qatar, for example, got the World Cup is like a major investigation now. FIFA is also quiet when people point out some of the way that labor laws are being flouted or human rights abuses that happen in Qatar. Secondly, the people who run football often have been around for sometimes 30, 40 years. We make fun of you know, the sort of light president of the average, well, let me not say average because that's generalizing, but like there are African countries, Equatorial Guinea or Angola, where somebody's been in power since late 1970s or early 1980s. Well, football's the same. The president of the Argentine FA, he's been there since 1979. All the terrible things that we find in the real world, we see in FIFA. So a lot of people are saying, yeah, let's reform FIFA, but it's very difficult because it's the way that FIFA is organized. Like, here's one example. The Nigerian football team did really badly in the World Cup. They came back home. The government, which has its own issues around accountability and its workiness around corruption, decided to get rid of the Football Association and, you know, try to elect like a new one. Like, let's clean up. Let's get a new president and let's have a new Congress. But you can't do it because FIFA's constitution says that countries cannot interfere in football. Like, the political leadership of a country cannot interfere in football. So you're in this catch-22 where we would like more accountability for FIFA, but we are, as a fan, or even, you know, God forbid if you're a player, there's like really zero control you have over the running of the game.
And what about the officiating? I mean, there are always tales of bribing officials, referees. Is that true?
This is true. Like, right before the tournament, there was a story broke that the chairperson of the Ghanaian FA, of the Ghanaian Football Association, had on camera agreed to throw some matches and that he was working with, you know, a certain number of referees. These are widespread problems. I think UEFA, which is the European controlling body, brought out a big study about match fixing in Europe that involved like a number of referees. And this is not to say there were match fixing in Brazil, but some of the refereeing in Brazil leaves a lot to desire for. I mean, and football, you're bound to have conspiracy theories. The way that Brazil's gotten away with tackles, free kicks, the penalty that was awarded to Greece in a game against the Ivory Coast, Cote d'Ivoire, in the last minute of the game, the way that the Netherlands beat Mexico when one of the Netherlands players just sort of fell over and won the penalty. Yes, it's gamesmanship on his part. Football lends itself to all these conspiracy theories because there are real instances where there's been match fixing and bribing.
Now, is it unusually subjective, the refereeing, compared to other sports?
It definitely is. I think this is one frustration that an American fan would have, or an American who's coming to football would have with it, which is like, unlike American football or the average American sports where you can call, you know, you can say, let's rewind the clock, let's review the play, then they would change the decision. in soccer, when the referee's blown the whistle, even if all the people in the stadium can see that this is a wrong decision, you can't reverse it. So yes, the game is very much dependent on the referee. You saw the game Brazil against Colombia, when the Colombian player went back into the back of Neymar, who was the brilliant star, and kind of fractured his vertebrae. The referee didn't see it, play goes on, and the guy had to go to the hospital. So there's a lot of those decisions where it's dependent on the referee.
Okay, now let's talk about the politics of it. First of all, the host country. A lot of protests in Brazil in the run-up to the World Cup. What were those all about, and what's your opinion of the issues?
My reading of it is like twofold. One is, I think, people in Brazil knows how football is run, and particularly how the World Cup is run. Like, when you get the World Cup, that you cede the authority about how you're going to run the tournament to FIFA. And that secondly, since the World Cup in 2002, starting with the World Cup in 2002 in Japan, Korea, what FIFA does is it insists that you build 14 new stadiums. They did the same with South Africa. And of course, the reason behind it is not because they would like to have people sit around in really new, beautiful stadiums, because Brazil has stadiums. It's because there's money to be made out of stadiums. So going into it, I think it sounds kind of strange now that Brazilians are acting in this way, because it shows a certain kind of naivety on the part of their political class and the part of the protesters. However, it's also true that like the World Cup presents like a really great opportunity if you're a Brazilian social activist, whether you're concerned about the policies of the government around neoliberalism, about militarism, around racism in Brazil, and Brazil is quite a racist society. The World Cup is like a great place to just get all that attention onto the cause that you are agitating towards. If you're trying to get the Brazilian government to care about housing, healthcare, quality of life, you can use the World Cup to shine a light on that. What's happening now in Brazil, I think, and from a good friend of mine, he moved to Rio, and he just came back, and I saw him last week, is that there's a tension between sort of the Brazilian national myth and Brazilian identity is built partly around football. And football has a great leveler around class and around race. So there's a tension between this run of the national team, you know, towards the final, where people sort of get on board with it and support it, and the contradictions of Brazil around inequality, around race, around class, which now and then rears its head with the way that the stadiums are mostly white, that the police are going, you know, breaking down people's homes because it's an eyesore close to a stadium. So my reading of it, I don't think Brazilians should be surprised by the World Cup, but I think it's a really good strategy on the part of social movements there to use the opportunity to shine a light on some of the mythologies that the Brazilian state or the Brazilian ruling class pulls off in normal time.
Now, you mentioned race in Brazil, which, of course, is a fascinating topic. We could spend hours talking about that in itself. But on your Football as a Country, a corner of your blog, there's a racial history of Neymar, which is very interesting. What happened with him over the years?
Two things. One is that there is a history in general in South America around national identity in which you privilege a sort of mestizo or mixed identity in which everybody is mixed, and you emphasize mostly, when you say everybody's mixed, you're mostly talking about Indio, you know, like native people and whites, like the former colonizers, the Spanish, like there's a history where you tell that. Secondly, there was always an obsession with whitening the nation. These are usually like political programs, whether it's Trujillo in Dominican Republic or many of the governments in Central America. And in Brazil, the way that this manifests itself is also in social life, like in, you know, who you see on television, who reads the news, who's in the soap operas. It's like very different from the way that we experience these things in the United States. I mean, it's a bit like how people in France talk about when they're watching television and they don't see any black people or Arabs reading the news. There's a way in which all that plays out. There's a way in which blackness is denigrated. Despite the fact that more than 50% of the people are obviously of African descent, there's a lot of issues around blackness. The piece by Ashraf Prabhala, who's on Wikipedia Foundation and lives in Bangalore, and he did this in conjunction with some Brazilian colleagues of his, is to look at sort of somebody like Neymar and to look at how over a very short period of time Neymar essentially became white because of the way that people deal with blackness. And he refers there that it's a really fascinating document that people can look at. I think it's 136 racial categories that when Brazilians were asked, like, how would you identify yourself? And the categories weren't pre-selected. So, you know, you could come up with your own, and they came up with 136 racial categories. Fair enough. People can be who they want to be, and we should encourage that. But it was obvious that these were ways that people were trying to deal with some of the negative connotation that comes with being black in Brazil. And being black in Brazil means being poor, you know, being sort of excluded. And there's been, right as the World Cup happened, the stadiums are mostly white Brazilians. You know, people asking, like, where are black people? And there are reasons. There are reasons about the obvious fact is because that's how inequality works in Brazil. And outside of the white ruling class, essentially most of the people who are poor are black. So in a way, Neymar is also doing, you can't blame him. This is his way of dealing with that society and trying to get away from that.
I'm speaking with Sean Jacobs, who's a professor at the New School in Manhattan and also one of the founders of the Africa is a Country blog. Okay, now let's talk some about there's always this sort of colonial subtext to a lot of World Cup matches. How do these colonial struggles get refought on the football field?
Two different ways. There's one way in which it just keep replaying itself, and if you're a fan, you can draw just on old grievances while you watch a game. You hate the old empire. So, for example, there's a popular phrase that goes around called anyone but England. Scottish fans, Irish fans, Welsh fans, when it comes to the World Cup, they don't want nothing to do with England. This is also happens in countries formerly colonized by Britain in Africa. There's some nuances to this, but in general, like if you know a little bit, you're not going to support England. I think similarly, in South America, people have issues around, like, we'll get to that in a minute. Argentina, I think, gets some of the brunt of that. You're in the French world, you have issues with France. But it gets complicated by one thing, which is sometimes these former colonizers, so the French team more than any other team, and they've embraced this as early as, like, the mid-90s, in 98. I mean, before that, they had players whose parents came from the former colonies. But particularly in 98, when they won the World Cup, with players whose fathers, mothers, you know, grandparents came from places like Algeria, from Senegal, Mali, and so on, and they won the World Cup. So from then on, it was known that France is a team that is representative, or that's the kind of vision of France as a team on the field. Maybe not with the state, maybe not with immigration, but when it comes to the football team. So in this World Cup, I think France was embraced as a sort of second team by most people who would, let's say, if you're supporting Nigeria, or you support Cote d'Ivoire, then often your second team would be France because, it, you know, it's a team that looks diverse and it includes players often that look like you. In the past, though, for me, when I was growing up, Brazil was that team. Brazil was our alternative team. They looked like us. It was a team of, you know, all kinds of people, but mostly black. And it was associated also with the style of play that Brazil had. Brazil had like a nice freewheeling style. It looked beautiful football, Joga Bonito. But increasingly, roughly since like the late 1980s, early 90s, Brazil plays like a sort of average European team, particularly like Italy, very defensively, very physical football, slow, and it doesn't look the same anymore. And with the light being shone on Brazil and all the stuff you can see about all the contradictions of Brazil, people have, you go through the tournament sort of like wondering, should I still support Brazil? Like, you know, you have this ambivalence toward Brazil. But then by the end of the quarterfinals, you left with four teams. You left with the Netherlands, Argentina, Brazil, and Germany as your four teams. And what do you do? Now by default, you're going to go back and you're going to support Brazil again. Because they look, you know, they represent the South. So this is, I think, also the way, you know, when you go from colonialism to sort of third worldism. So you have problems with the way Brazil is governed, with the way Brazil deals with race and class, with the contradictions of Brazil. The other options are Germany and the Netherlands, which it's also a very diverse team, but the Netherlands also has really retrogressive immigration politics. It still thinks it's okay to celebrate blackface characters. This is not the fault of the players on the field, but I think this often happens to people when they're watching football. If you're on Twitter during an average match, particular team, a game involving a team from the South versus a team from the North, then these things come up. An interesting case, however, is the United States. I mean, most people have major, you know, outside the U.S., and I assume, and I know that there are people also inside the U.S. that share some of these sentiments around U.S. militarism or kind of the, you know, American jingoism. But then the U.S., they put a team on the field that is quite diverse and that is a little bit more representative of, like, what the United States looks like, particularly in kind of the major metros. And they also play really with a certain grit, like they, and this might be a stereotype of the United States as a team. In the World Cup, this is the only time the World Cup, I think the Olympics less so, when the U.S. almost competes equally with other nations. And so what was fascinating was watching people after the U.S. lost to Belgium, and Belgium is like a country with like 4 million people. You know, it has its own issues, but it actually has a very diverse team. The captain, his father is from Congo. The main striker was born in the Congo. Players from Angola, players from Kenya. But what's interesting is like a lot of people sort of gravitated towards the United States by the end of the match in the way that they kind of identified with and saw the U.S. as an underdog. Kind of a mix of like colonialism, third worldism, underdogism, that all sort of comes up when you're in a World Cup. And then the U.S., brought on players. The way that ESPN kind of marketed this was problematic. It's sort of like, these are the children of ex-servicemen, and they're now giving their service for their country. So, you know, they wrote it up in their narrative of America. But many other people read it differently, that this was another sign of kind of how open America is to immigration, to the idea of like who can be an American. It's a much more progressive notion of it, maybe at a very limited level. And so you can identify that. And you see a Native American player who's a member, I think, of a Native American tribe came on, Wondolowski. Another player who's part Native American and African American. He's kind of becoming a sort of a breakout player of the tournament. He played he was sort of a defender, but sort of played on the wing. He's from Seattle. You know, when people see that, they can see something about another kind of America. Of course, there are gripes like, why weren't there any more Latino players in the American team? But the football team shows a lot more possibility around, you know, there were African-American players at the heart of that team, DeMarcus Beasley and others. So I think that's what football does. It not just brings up sort of all the sort of negative things that we hold about ourselves, but it also, or that we remember, but it also get people to think about ways to think about a different kind of world. For Africans, for example, Pan-Africanism, I think, only comes up when it's football. When it was Ghana in 2010, almost going to the quarterfinals before Suarez caught the ball with his hand in the net, and fair play to him, that's what you do for your team. But Africans were behind Ghana in that tournament. I think similarly, Algeria, one of the odd things was here you had Algeria, which is as a country, and after the game, their players dedicated their victory to the Arabs, to the Arab world. But most Africans on the continent, people in the diaspora, people living in the US and the UK or wherever in Europe, identified with the Algerian team. They wanted Algeria to win. Similarly, Africans identified with the Colombian team. Colombia doesn't treat its African population very well, but there's a way in which in that 90 minutes, and I think it only lasts for that 90 minutes really, there's a way in which all these emotions and all these hopes center on what's happening on the field.
And finally, soccer in the U.S. We don't even use the same word that most of the world uses. Ann Coulter was busy denouncing it in a few stupid columns as a European sissy sport. Is this finally the breakthrough where soccer will become a more American sport, this World Cup?
It depends on who's asking. So if you're asking as a business, if you like, you know, television business, yes, more people watch the World Cup, watch some of the games involving Mexico, involving the United States, than they would watch the NBA playoffs. Nobody even remembered there was an NBA playoffs going on. And actually, baseball really is now, I think, about the fourth. So it's probably still American football, basketball, and then soccer, which has more viewers, I think, right now than baseball or ice hockey. So, yes, if you think it's viable as a, you know, TV person, yeah, this is, football has arrived. But the truth is, football's been here all along. It has a long history. And not just, you know, the obvious thing among immigrant communities, and particularly like immigrants from Central and South America, and because that's what, when people say has it arrived, I think they mean mostly has it arrived with white Americans. There's been like football, there's a long history of football here that dates back to like the 1930s, 1920s. The U.S. is one of the first members, I think, of FIFA, played in the World Cup in 1950, where they beat England. Then when people talk about what's the U.S.'s greatest victory, it was actually that victory in the 1950 against England. So the U.S. has a long history of soccer or football. I think it's about the commercial viability. So it, and also, like, there's lots of kids playing soccer, you know, everywhere and anywhere. But, yeah, as a commercial entity, I think this is more proof that there's lots of people caring, watching. I think actually the 2010 World Cup was probably where I noticed for the first time many people, just random people. I would go to a bar and watch a World Cup match with them and see finally that it affected them. Before that, they would just, you know, watch the 1990 World Cup, the U.S. qualifies, 94, the U.S. hosts it, so it's a big spectacle, it's like a party, and then, you know, it's like the circus, and then it leaves town. But then after that, the U.S. played in basically every World Cup, but it was 2010 where you could see, and I've been here, you know, probably during every World Cup since 98, for parts of it, because I would often go back to South Africa or I'd be in Europe or something. But in general, I think 2010 was when Americans were, like, feeling defeat. When they lost to Ghana in the round of 16, that was when they were like, oh, we could do this. And I think this World Cup, there was just, and you could see it also with ESPN, there was really a feeling of, we have a strong team. If we play out brand of football, which is kind of a mix of sort of really defensive football, it doesn't have like great tactics. It doesn't have like lots of creative players. And I think that's when I was making my remark earlier about opening the team up to more than just the children of American GIs. And if you want sort of footballers, and again, this is generalizing coming from the suburbs, but they don't have a playmaker in the middle, but just purely on really good defense, Tim Howard, like, I mean, that was crazy. People were like, we could go far in this World Cup. So the disappointment, I think, reflected that. This was the second time now where Americans feel like how everybody else was feeling. And if you were on Twitter right after the game, you could see how the rest of the world reacted. They were like, not so much like welcome, but like there was a grudging respect. Because everybody kind of, to be frank, a lot of people hate America when it comes to soccer. People are like, here they are again. They have lots of money, the best training. But I think this time people were like, you know what? They got our respect. They can play.
Well, I bet the TV people though can't stand those 45 minutes without a commercial break.
Well, I think they try to like use the water breaks. They understand one of the channels, I think it was ESPN, they took a break in one of them and showed some ads. They couldn't wait. They were like, whoa, there's a water break. If you read, even I saw a letter to the New York Post where someone said, I actually could go with soccer. Like, you know, it's usually 90 minutes and at worst it will be 120 minutes compared to going for hours on end to a baseball game or an American football game, which in truth, a basketball game is really four quarters of what, 12 minutes each?
15, isn't it?
15 minutes each. That game should really last you like an hour, but it's lasting like 4 or 5 hours because it has all this commercial activity and it's so tied to all kinds of things that happens around the game. Whereas soccer, yes, you can create distractions with advertising boards and studio, back to the studio and all that, but you cannot get rid of the fundamentals of the game, which is 90 minutes, two halves, one referee, and anything can happen. Because in American sports, there's such an obsession with getting it right. It takes all the, I don't want to call it like chance. Soccer allows for chance or anything can happen. This is why weak teams, you know, small teams like Costa Rica, everybody's like, whoa, maybe Costa Rica, they're going on this run. And by the, you know, it's a dreary match for the 90 minutes, but in the extra time, people are like, what people are concentrating is, can this small country, can they turn up? Can they hold on? And then when they lose in penalties, everybody's deflated. That's still the romance of this game. But outside of that 90 minutes, and of course we talked about the refereeing and so on, it's a mess. It's a mess about how it's governed. It's a mess about the racism around fans in not just in particularly Western Europe, but as it now turns out, some of Brazil's and Argentina's racism gets reflected also in the stands. But yeah, it's still the best sport.
That was Sean Jacobs, an assistant professor of international affairs at the New School in Manhattan, who is both a scholar and fan of soccer. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of Macht, or Power, by Melodia. Till next week, bye.